This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture. I'm PJ Thumb and I'm a historian from the University of Oxford, and this is the history of Singapore. Episode 13, The Yellow Lion and the Red Sun. It is the morning of 8th December 1941. Japanese bombs fall on Malaya for the first time, and in particular, on its most important city, Singapore. The main targets are the Salita and Tengah airfields, but the bombs also fall on Raffles Place in the heart of town. The unsuspecting city was at rest, a blaze of light, its working population asleep or at work, the European population still partying and drinking. Indeed, few believed that Singapore was in danger. Before the bombs fell, Singapore still had peace. No food rationing, no urgency, no sense of danger. Malaya's main role in the European war was supposed to be as a dollar arsenal, providing cheap rubber and tin for the war effort. The War Office set wages at half the market rate, all the better to make a profit. War in Malaya seemed a distant concept. Indeed, the British didn't believe the Japanese would invade Southeast Asia. Until September 1941, Singapore authorities tried to remain friendly with the Japanese. On 1st October 1941, Air Chief Marshal Sir Robert Brooke Popham, commander of land and air forces in the Far East, told London that, quote, "The last thing the Japanese want at this juncture is a campaign to the south," unquote. Just over 2 months later, all within a few hours on the night of 7th December, the Japanese destroyed the American fleet at Pearl Harbor, invaded Hong Kong and the Philippines, landed troops at Singora, Petani and Kota Bharu, and dropped the first bombs on Singapore. The two empires were now at war, and Malayans would be caught in between them. The British hesitated and hesitated. Their air and sea power were quickly knocked out by the Japanese, with, most famously, the great battleship the Prince of Wales and the cruiser Repulse sunk on 10th December. In a Kirimomi Sakusen, or driving charge, the Japanese swept down the Malayan Peninsula, carried forward by audacious planning, good luck and sheer momentum. On 18th December, Penang fell to the Japanese. The British banned the media from reporting this, but news quickly leaked out. Singaporeans were horrified to learn that only Europeans were evacuated from Penang, leaving locals to their fate, and demanded to know if the same would happen to Singapore. The British army, undermined by a lack of air and sea support, ran into disaster after disaster. The Japanese commander, Lieutenant General Yamashita Tomoyuki, probably the best general in the Japanese army, brilliantly used his control of air and sea to outflank and bewilder the British Imperial forces, surrounding them and compelling them repeatedly to withdraw or be cut off. British officials bickered and argued. The colonial civil service and military generals were full of scholars, graduates of top universities who were excellent administrators, but useless in a real crisis. One of them was General Arthur Percival, the general officer commanding Malaya. He had warned that if the Japanese broke through British imperial defences at the Moa River, then Singapore was lost. On 16th January, the Japanese broke through British imperial defences at the Moa River. In London, the British government considered abandoning Singapore and diverting forces to Burma, where they still had a fighting chance. But they decided not to, for political reasons. Of course, they felt some responsibility to us Malayans. But more importantly, they did not want to lose face when compared to how the Chinese were savagely fighting in China, the Russians in Russia, and most of all, the Americans and Filipinos in the Philippines, whose battles against the Japanese are the stuff of legend. But most importantly, abandoning Malaya meant also abandoning the Australians because of Singapore's position as part of Australian forward defence. When word leaked out that the British were considering abandoning Singapore for Burma, Australian Prime Minister Brian Curzon cabled Churchill to accuse him of, quote, "an inexcusable betrayal," unquote, of Australia. So Churchill decided to fight on. But it wasn't to save us. It was to save the white people in Australia. As the Japanese tide rolled down the peninsula, closer and closer to Singapore, the British finally began rallying the local population to the defence of Malaya. Strangely enough, the British never made more than half-hearted attempts to rally the local population. Much of the Malay and Indian population were, of course, already connected with the colonial establishment, and many served as policemen and military. But the vast majority of Singapore were Chinese, and the British were not keen at all to mobilise them. They never trusted them, either because the British thought they were inferior, or because the British thought their loyalties were suspect. But with the Japanese at the gates, Governor Shenton Thomas asked Tan Kah Kee to convene a meeting at the Singapore Chinese Chamber of Commerce. At this meeting, a Singapore Chinese Mobilisation Committee was formed. It created a volunteer police force headed by Tay Koh Yat, and a labour section under Lim Bo Seng, which would carry out construction work and so on. But most importantly, the Malayan Communist Party, the MCP, was welcomed as, quote, loyal supporters of the British cause, unquote. Huh. Communist manifestos urging all-out war were printed in the three English-language newspapers, and political prisoners were released from jail. Quote, post-war repercussions do not concern us in an emergency, unquote, wrote Shenton Thomas to his boss, the Secretary of State for the Colonies in London. But the volunteers weren't armed. Initially, only former military were armed. No weapons. How to fight? The Mobilisation Council urged the government to arm the Chinese, and a big group of Chinese actually held a demonstration where they marched through the streets chanting, "Give us guns and we will fight." But Tan Kah Kee disagreed with this because he felt that the British did not care about the Chinese, never cared about the Chinese, and giving local Chinese guns would just give the Japanese more of an excuse to kill Chinese, to exact terrible vengeance on the Chinese when the British inevitably abandoned Singapore. He believed the British were terrible hypocrites, only trusting the Chinese now out of desperation when they faced defeat. This was a fight between two imperialist foreign forces, neither of whom cared about the locals. So he argued the Chinese should be restricted to non-combat roles. But the British were desperate, and so finally in January 1942, the British finally began arming Chinese volunteers. They created a Singapore Chinese anti-Japanese volunteer battalion. It was a Chinese battalion with only one of its members not Chinese. And so, of course, the British nicknamed it after the one non-Chinese member, its commander, Lieutenant Colonel John Daly, who was a policeman. It was called Dalforce, and it was armed, but only with basic weapons, parangs, shotguns, grenades. But the line was crossed. In anger, Tan Kah Kee condemned his force, closed down his factories, paid off his workers, and left Singapore, convinced that any Chinese remaining would be massacred once the British inevitably surrendered or fled the country. He was right. Thousands of Chinese would die in the first day alone after the fall of Singapore. On the 9th of 7 December, 2 months to the day after they started the war, the Japanese crossed over the Johor Straits and closed in on the city. On 13 February, despite the valiant defence by the Malay Regiment, they broke through the gap on Pasir Panjang Ridge. This is the famous Battle of Bukit Chandu. This brought Japanese artillery within range of the city. On 15th February, Chinese New Year, Percival met with Yamashita and surrendered. Percival would take most of the blame for the loss, but in reality, this was systemic. The British had, for over 150 years, governed Malaya with a tiny colonial administration, with the aid of local Malay and Chinese collaborators. It had gotten by on smoke and mirrors, with its authority and competency never fully tested. When the test came, it failed. The British were in Malaya first and foremost to exploit locals, to make money, not to win loyalties or build a new country. Even when war broke out, money was prioritized. It was only when the Japanese were on the very doorstep that they, rather half-heartedly, changed their minds. So in sum, the British grossly underestimated the Japanese, made numerous tactical mistakes, suffered from infighting and hesitation and a lack of coordination. They created a naval base without ships, airfields without airplanes, understaffed and underfunded Malaya. This is not to understate, of course, the individual heroism of many British servicemen who fought and died for Malaya, or of individual British colonial civil servants who passionately cared about Malaya as their home. This is an indictment of 150 years of colonialism, which had prioritized exploitation and extraction and capitalism, which had underinvested in the country, never fully developing it, which had sought government on the cheap, which had never fully trusted the local population, to which it had consistently sent its worst colonial civil service graduates, who had lived in denial, dancing at Raffles Hotel and going to movies and theme parks until the very end. This is an indictment of an entire system of colonial government. Fundamentally, the British lost Malaya because they had never truly cared about us, only about making money from us. But in this destruction of the colonial establishment came an opportunity. All the strands of local Malayan nationalism that had been in development over the past few decades, all these strands which the British had forcibly suppressed, could now re-emerge. They had a new common enemy, and they would be catalyzed by this opportunity. The ruling classes of Malaya had been amazed by the inspired heroism of Dalforce in blocking the Bukit Timah Road, and by Chinese irregulars, vigilantes, guerrillas, men and women who simply picked up weapons and fought the invaders. The feats of the Malay Regiment and the Asian and Eurasian contingent of the Strait Settlements Volunteer Corps were inspiring. The unwavering devotion of the auxiliary civilian voluntary workers, the stoic fortitude of ordinary citizens, men, women, children, in the face of death and disaster, the courage of Singapore's people embarrassed the British, who found it particularly humiliating that at the final hour they had to beg for help from people they previously were contemptuous of. Men like Tan Kah Kee and Lim Bo Seng, and most of all the Malayan Communist Party. The fall of Singapore was a tragedy, but in its tragedy the people of Singapore would find inspiration from the courage they had displayed. It showed exactly what we were made of. BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, and I'm PJ Thum. If you've just joined us, welcome to this week's episode of The History of Singapore, The Yellow Lion and the Red Sun. One empire had ripped Malaya from the hands of another empire, but it was the people of Malaya, caught in between, who suffered. But they did not suffer equally. In terms of its impact on post-war politics, on independence movements, the most important consequence of the Japanese occupation was that it exacerbated racial tensions and created divisions in the races, which would have a major impact on post-war politics and on our independence movement. And indeed, these divisions continue to present day. The Japanese treated Singapore's different ethnic and linguistic communities very differently. They did not create the racial tensions, of course, the tensions were already there. But the Japanese made them much, much worse. And also how the communities responded to the occupation is also really important. Their choices, their responses were very different, and these also drove the communities apart. The Japanese actually wasted a huge opportunity. They were not welcomed as liberators, as they were, for example, in Java, but few were sad to see the British go. Their victory inspired awe, and they had made the British look pathetic. Many Chinese had been thoroughly alienated by the British regime, especially by the Chinese protectorate. Many Indians were stirred by the anti-British nationalist movement in India. The Malays were poor because of systemic neglect, because they were restricted to the rural economy. The Eurasians had been discriminated against by being barred from positions of power or any social equality by the ruling European colonial class. So the opportunity was there. But the Japanese blew it by treating people with hostility and brutality, and by treating the different communities very differently, and especially by treating the Chinese viciously. Let's start with the Indians. Central to the Japanese conquest was the recruitment of Indians to the Indian Independence League and the creation of the Indian National Army, with the purpose of undermining British rule in India and launching a political and military campaign for Indian independence. Central to the Japanese advance was winning defection from Indian units in the British forces. Many Indians experienced terrible racism in the British army, so their defection is understandable purely on a personal level. But for Indian nationalists, people who wanted Indian independence and freedom from colonialism, the Japanese were a godsend. The Indian National Army was formed in 1942, but struggled until the great Indian nationalist Subhas Chandra Bose arrived in Singapore. Bose was a hardline radical nationalist, twice elected president of the Indian National Congress, popular among its members, seen as an equal or a rival of Nehru. But he had fallen out with Gandhi because he disagreed with Gandhi's pacifism and demanded full and immediate independence from Britain. Indeed, he had won the presidency of the Indian National Congress despite openly quarrelling with Gandhi. That's how popular he was. But the rest of the Congress leadership refused to work with him, and so he resigned and founded his own faction, the All India Forward Bloc. He was arrested by the British, but later escaped India and fled to Germany in 1941, and from there went to Japan in 1943. On 4th of July 1943, 2 days after reaching Singapore, Bose assumed the leadership of the Indian Independence League and the Indian National Army in a ceremony at Cathay Building. Bose reinvigorated the Indian National Army, which previously consisted of prisoners of war, people from the British Army who had been captured by the Japanese in their blitzkrieg down the peninsula. Indian expatriates in Southeast Asia flocked to him. He was a stirring orator, arguing that Gandhi's civil disobedience movement would not work, arguing that the only way for India to be free was to drive out the British. He famously proclaimed, "Give me blood, I will give you freedom." But it is important to remember that, even throughout this creation of political unity, the Indian community in Singapore was never homogenous. They remained highly differentiated in terms of religion, class, and their level of pro-nationalist sentiment, and also their opinion of the Japanese. In general, the Hindus were more loyal to the Congress Party and the Muslims to the Indian Independence League. The middle class and professional class were more Congress, the labourers and workers more League. But there are generalisations and many exceptions abound. And of course the Parsis, for example, you'll remember from a previous episode, still didn't consider themselves Indian and remained pro-British. And how you were treated also matters. Indians and Japanese occupied Hong Kong, for example, were better treated than in Singapore, and perhaps because of that were less radical and far fewer joined the League. Among the Malays, we return to our old friend Ibrahim Yaakob of the Kesatuan Melayu Buddha, the great Malay nationalist leader we discuss in episode 9. He was released from prison 1 day after the Japanese occupation of Singapore on 16th February 1942. The Japanese opposed the establishment of independent political associations, but agreed to allow the reconstitution of the KMM as a cultural association. This was not what Ibrahim wanted. Indeed, fellow KMM member Ahmad Bostamam writes that after they were released, Ibrahim addressed their group and said, quote, "The Japanese army victory does not mean victory for the Malay people. We must continue to struggle for our aspirations, and our victory can only be achieved when the aspirations for which we struggle are duly achieved." Unquote. So, to Ibrahim, working with Japan was not a goal, but a means to an end, specifically the full independence of Malaya. Ibrahim continued to request independence, and unsurprisingly, the Japanese soon disbanded the KMM in June 1942. Ibrahim continued to work with the Japanese and later was appointed to head a local volunteer military force called Pembela Tanah Air, or Defenders of the Homeland. However, he kept playing both sides. In his 1957 book, he claimed that he also reached out to the Malayan People's Anti-Japanese Army and the MCP in early 1944 and worked with them. The KMM continued to meet secretly, unbeknownst to the Japanese, in the old Istana in Kampong Glam. Other Malays also resisted in their own way. It is in this period that a young nationalist by the name of Samad Ismail became the editor of the Berita Malay, which was the main Malay language newspaper in occupied Singapore. Samad is, without question, one of the most important members of Singapore's independence movement. With the death of more senior editors, Samad became editor at the age of 19, and while he had to toe the Japanese line, he would circumvent censorship by writing subtle nationalist messages in his articles and stories and poems. He was aided by the fact that the Japanese promoted Malay alongside Japanese as an official language. So, Indian nationalists were fighting for a free India, and Malay nationalists for a free Malaya. And to them, the Japanese were an opportunity. After all, what is the difference between one empire and another when you're not free? The opportunity is there, you might as well seize it. But you can also see how, from the perspective of Singapore's Chinese, who were not privy to the internal politics and secret maneuvers of both parties, who did not know about Ibrahim Yaakob trying to play both sides, or who missed Samad Ismail's very subtle nationalist messages, it looked like the Indians and the Malays were collaborating with the Japanese. And this mattered because, of course, the Japanese were very brutal towards the Chinese. It's estimated that at least 5,000 Chinese died in the first day alone after the fall of Singapore. Chinese leaders were arrested and beaten and forced to raise $10 million to support the Japanese. Most famously, Chinese were massacred in a campaign called the Suk Ching, or Purification Through Purge. This famous campaign is well known among the public today, as it is taught in Singapore's national education curriculum. But I think what the syllabus leaves out or understates or doesn't really explain clearly is why Suk Ching took place. It was not a mindless, indiscriminate campaign of violence, but a targeted one that was poorly implemented and went out of control. The prime targets of Suk Ching were the people whom the Japanese feared the most. These included people involved in anti-Japanese activities, including China Relief Fund members, members of Dal Force, secret society members, intellectuals, new arrivals from China, and most of all, the people who fought hardest and with greatest determination against the Japanese, Kuomintang and MCP members. So to this end, Chinese were herded into registration centres. But these were unevenly run. At some, those who were suspected of anti-Japanese activities were efficiently separated and everyone else sent home. At others, tens of thousands of people were held for a week in the open without food or water and were indiscriminately beaten. At times, Japanese military police randomly condemned people. Because, after all, how do you tell an anti-Japanese person apart from one who didn't care? You can't. They all look the same. So they would, for example, arrest lots of Hainanese, because, as regular listeners of this show know, until the mid-1930s, the MCP was overwhelmingly Hainanese. Or they would arrest men with tattoos, since a tattoo might indicate membership of a secret society. Or men with glasses, or the well-dressed, or whatever else they thought might indicate anti-Japaneseness. These people were rounded up and machine-gunned or thrown overboard at sea. Between 25,000 and 50,000 people were massacred in 2 weeks. We'll never truly know how many died. So Suk Ching had a purpose, but it was ineffective and called off after 2 weeks. Its lasting impact was to make the Chinese community hate the Japanese with a bitter fury, one which naturally would be extended to those who were seen to collaborate with the Japanese. And later, this conflict would become overt. After the fall of Singapore, Dal Force fled into the Malayan jungle, linking up with the MCP to form the Malayan People's Anti-Japanese Army. The MPAJA formed the main guerrilla resistance to Japanese rule and was composed largely of Chinese belonging to the MCP. Meanwhile, the Japanese deployed largely Malay units against them in order to reserve their own troops for the war. Hence, the closing days of the war actually saw Chinese and Malays in open conflict with each other. And so, this has huge implications for the future independence of Malaya. This is one of the two main impacts of the Japanese occupation. The first, of course, is well known. The British were swept away, along with any belief in their superiority or right to rule. This belief, it turned out, had been crucial to British rule because if you actually raised an army and took on the British, it turned out they didn't have much military capacity or stomach to fight. And this was a lesson that the MCP would draw upon just 2.5 years later. But the second, and arguably more important consequence of the Japanese occupation, was to accelerate long-standing communal trends, to exacerbate long-standing communal divisions, to catalyze the politicization of Singapore, and in particular of its three major communities, firing up new political agendas among the Indians and Malays, turning the Chinese into a bitter, angry, frustrated community, setting the communities against each other. And indeed, this conflict would turn hot immediately after the Japanese surrender in 1945. Before the British returned, Chinese resistance groups violently punished suspected Japanese collaborators, who were chiefly Malay, and Malays responded with bloody reprisals on the Chinese. And this, unfortunately, set the stage for the independence movement, which began when the British returned to a Malaya that no longer wanted them. So join us next week as we come back to where we started 13 episodes ago with the story of the Malayan Union. As always, if you have any questions, comments or feedback, please email me at thehistoryofsingapore@gmail.com or visit my webpage at thehistoryofsingapore.com. If you'd like to support the show, please visit Patreon, patreon.com/pjthumb. This has been The History of Singapore, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.